based on hard evidence. Whatever the best approach to tort reform is, Obamacare opens itself up for just criticism by harping on overutilization as a central problem of the current healthcare system, and then turning around and doing nothing to discourage defensive medicine, one of its most significant drivers. The charge of conservatives that President Obama and his party were more concerned with placating their supporters, the trial lawyers who get rich on fat legal settlements and jury awards, than in sincerely seeking to fix the healthcare system, is strengthened by the glaring inconsistency within Obamacare between loud overutilization complaints and complete tort reform silence. Part 4. Obamacare, the Fine Print. Chapter 12. Making Americans Healthier. If you paid attention during the national debate over Obamacare before it became law, you might think that President Obama's healthcare reform agenda was concerned only with government takeover of the nation's healthcare system and death panels deciding end-of-life questions for individuals. These were and are important issues for sure, but the finished law is about more than its most controversial components. Well, few have noticed, Obamacare includes a new initiative designed to help Americans live healthier lives. It creates a National Prevention, Health Promotion, and Public Health Council to help manage the government's efforts to promote personal wellness. The council will spend a year or more reviewing the subject and issue a report with recommendations on how to improve the overall health of the American people in order to help them avoid serious health conditions. Beyond federal oversight, Obamacare includes specific provisions to move us closer to the end goal of being healthier as a nation. These include no copays for approved preventive tests. These are now guaranteed as essential health benefits and include things like mammograms and colonoscopies, approval of and support for employer-based programs that reward employees for personal wellness, nutritional labeling for food served in restaurants, increased spending in Medicaid for preventive services, prevention counseling in Medicare. No copays for approved preventive services. Signaling its intention to take prevention seriously, Obamacare requires insurance plans, both those on the private market and those sold through the exchanges, to cover the cost of government-approved preventive services, such as breast cancer screenings and cholesterol tests. This means that plan participants can no longer be charged copays when they want to have one of these tests conducted. Plans with grandfathered status, however, will be exempted from the new requirement, which apply to all insurance plans from January 1, 2011 onward, regardless of when a participant enrolled. Obamacare's controversial mandate requiring all insurers to make contraception available to women has been made under the law's provision that preventive services be made available without copays. The Catholic Church has challenged this rule, arguing that pregnancy is not a disease that needs to be prevented, but rather a normal and necessary condition that women experience at times to perpetuate the existence of humanity. Prevention as a guaranteed essential health benefit. The Department of Health and Human Services has yet to determine these specific preventive tests that must be covered by insurance plans going forward, but eventually it will publish a list of procedures that are part of a package of essential health benefits. In creating the list of approved preventive procedures, the Health and Human Services Secretary will be aided by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, USPSTF, a government body that evaluates and rates the effectiveness of different preventive tests. Tests that receive a grade of A or B are deemed to be particularly effective and therefore recommended to all Americans or to those belonging to appropriate demographic groups. Under the new law, All preventive procedures receiving these A or B stamps of approval must be covered by insurance plans without copays. The power of the USPSTF comes not only through the preventive tests it recommends, but also through those it does not. This negative power, the ability to steer Americans away from specific tests, generated controversy during the national debate over Obamacare when the task force ruled that women under the age of 50 no longer needed to get mammograms to screen for breast cancer. This declaration, stoking fears among many who were already concerned that Obamacare would ultimately end in the rationing of medical services, unleashed a wave of angry criticism that fell on President Obama and Democrats with a loud thud. Although the controversy was quickly diffused when a special provision was inserted into the final law that said younger women would still be able to get mammograms included with their coverage, it highlighted the potential for similar flare-ups in the future. Whenever government limits or restricts the access of Americans to specific healthcare procedures, it is bound to upset people who value those procedures, even if they only represent the viewpoint of a small minority. To give a flavor of the tests which will eventually be covered, here is a list of prominent tests that currently receive the USPSTF's highest ratings. For those interested in learning more about whether a specific procedure is covered, the full list can be found on the task force's website at https://epss.ahrq.gov, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Procedure: aspirin to prevent heart disease. Group recommended for men 45 to 99, women 55 to 79. Cervical cancer screening for sexually active women. Colorectal cancer screening for adults 50 to 75. High blood pressure screening for adults 18 plus. Tobacco use counseling for adults 18 plus. Breast cancer mammogram, women 50 to 74. Depression screening, teens and adults 18 plus. Health diet counseling, adults with risk of heart disease. Obesity screening, children 6 to 17 and adults 18 plus. Type 2 diabetes screening, adults with high blood pressure. As for immunizations, those recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will be deemed part of the essential health benefits package that all insurance plans must cover under the new law. Employer-based personal wellness reward programs. With approved preventive tests guaranteed to all Americans, Obamacare also puts an emphasis on employer-based insurance plans to help improve the personal wellness of the population. Opening a new door for employers, the law permits them to offer financial rewards to their employees who make a measurable effort toward improving their health. Specifically, it lets an employer reduce the premiums, copays, and deductibles of its employees who meet specific personal wellness thresholds. Under the same conditions, it also lets them increase the benefits employees can receive under a given insurance plan. As of 2011, the total value of the financial reward an employer can offer to an employee who meets a personal wellness standard is capped at 30% of the cost of the employee's total coverage. In 2014, employers may increase the reward level to 50%. To prevent employers from unfairly discriminating against less healthy workers, the law requires that they set up a different standard for employees who cannot reasonably meet those set up in the insurance plan for the employer's workforce as a whole. A report reviewing the operation of employer-based wellness programs throughout the United States will be issued by 2013. In addition, small businesses will have access to grants to help them overcome any unique challenges they may have compared to larger businesses in setting up such programs. These grants will begin in 2011 and end in 2016. Moving beyond employer-based plans, Obamacare also sets up an extensive pilot program in 2014, whereby private insurance plans in 10 states will be encouraged to set up similar wellness programs. At the conclusion of 3 years, the pilot program will be reviewed, and if it proves effective, it could be expanded to more states in 2017. Nutritional information in restaurants. You won't only encounter Obamacare when you go to see your doctor. Its provisions will also affect you when you go to a restaurant. As of 2011, all restaurants with 20 or more locations have to provide nutritional information and calorie counts on their menus. Vending machines must do the same. Increased funding for preventive services in Medicaid. Under provisions that took effect in 2011, Medicaid now only covers preventive services approved by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. As with all other insurance plans, copays will be eliminated for those procedures that receive the task force's A or B rating. More importantly, states that provide Medicaid coverage for the recommended procedures and eliminate copays will receive a 1% increase in the so-called Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, or FMAP, for these services. This aims to encourage states to support prevention efforts, and Medicaid recipients themselves are given incentives to live healthier lives. Although specifics about these incentives remain vague, one initiative that was explicitly written into the new law requires Medicaid to cover tobacco cessation services and products for pregnant women. Prevention counseling in Medicare. As with Medicaid, Medicare recipients are encouraged to live healthier lives with a handful of new incentives, including the elimination of copays for approved preventive procedures. To further help with that effort, Medicare recipients are able to work with their doctors to develop a prevention plan customized to their specific needs. Additional costs for a healthier America. The new initiatives designed to foster prevention and wellness are a step in the right direction, but it's an open question whether or not they will truly improve the general health of the American people. Ironically, perhaps, Obamacare could actually increase health and medical costs rather than reduce them. More preventive tests may bring more diagnosed health problems that require costly treatment that will raise healthcare spending above current levels. Although we should all want to extend human life as much as possible, we should not be blind to the fact that a healthier, longer-living population will require more healthcare. Still, the United States' standing on life expectancy in the world has become something of a national embarrassment, especially given the gigantic amount of money we spend on healthcare compared to other developed nations. Improving the diets and lifestyles of Americans, assuming they can be improved by government policy, is probably at least as important as fixing the healthcare system itself. Chapter 13, Long-Term Care. At some point, most American families face difficult choices about how to care for aging parents and grandparents. Some involve life-or-death medical decisions. Others have to do with assisted living support, either at home or in a nursing home. About 10 million families in the United States now have to deal with the challenges of long-term care, and that number will grow as the population ages significantly over the next 50 years. Realizing the growing importance of this issue and the financial burden it can impose on families, Obamacare made an effort to help Americans care for old and/or disabled family members with new forms of government support, the most notable of which was the CLASS government-run assisted living insurance program. This aspect of the new law was the legacy of the late Senator Ted Kennedy, the foremost champion of a government-supported long-term care program. CLASS, however, was one of the most controversial parts of Obamacare, and the White House finally decided in October 2011 to pull the plug on it, admitting that the insurance plan could not sustain itself over the long term through enrollee contributions. Participation in the plan was to be voluntary. This was a major victory for the legion of class critics who had denounced the plan as another budget-busting entitlement and a major defeat for Obamacare, as class was one of its most important components. Although class is now officially suspended, it has not been repealed by Congress. Because it could potentially come back to life in some form, we offer the following description of the plan as it stood before the White House's decision not to go forward with it. Class insurance. Class, short for Community Living Assistance Services and Supports, was designed to be insurance that would provide financial help for those who cannot complete basic living tasks, such as feeding, dressing, and bathing. People limited in this way are mostly senior citizens, but a sizable portion of those who need such care, about 40% of the total, are under age 65 and disabled. Class was intended to ease the heavy burden of assisted living expenses for needy individuals and provide additional money so that they don't have to rely only on Medicaid, private insurance, and their family's financial resources to make life bearable. It was not intended to cover all assisted living expenses, but rather meant as a supplemental financial resource. According to an insurance trade group, about 8 million long-term care policies exist in the United States today, with the average buyer in his or her late 50s and annual premiums a little over $2,000 per year. Class relied on these private policies as a general template to create the government's own insurance plan, the highlights of which are as follows. Management and oversight. The class program would be managed by the Department of Health and Human Services, which would determine the rules and set premium levels. Voluntary participation. No one would be forced to contribute to class. Any adult age 18 and older would be allowed to participate either through their employer, if it offers class as part of its insurance package, or directly through the government. Payroll deductions and automatic enrollment. Class would be funded through payroll deductions, yet to be determined. Premiums would vary according to the age of the enrollee, with younger workers paying less than older ones. Importantly, health status cannot be used as a reason to charge higher premiums under class. Employers who might offer class to their workforce would have to automatically enroll each of their workers, but each enrollee would be able to opt out if they wish. Start of program. The class program was to have been created in 2011, with enrollments beginning in October 2012. 5-year vesting plan. The plan would not pay out any benefits for the first 5 years of a person's enrollment. Enrollee contributions in the form of monthly premiums would build up slowly over time, eventually forming a self-sustaining pool of money to pay out benefits. The law specifies that class must pay for itself and that taxpayer dollars may not be used to support payments to beneficiaries. Benefit eligibility. All enrollees who have more than one functional limitation which impairs their ability to live a normal day-to-day life would be able to receive benefits. A doctor's certification would be required as proof that a limitation exists. To qualify for benefits, a person must have paid class premiums for at least 5 years and have been employed for at least 3 of them. Cash benefit. Many details of class still need to be worked out, but the provision indicates those who qualify for benefits would receive a lifetime cash benefit amounting to, at minimum, $50 per day. The exact benefit level would be based on the severity of the functional limitation. If implemented, it's expected to amount to about $75 a day, or $27,375 per year on average for all beneficiaries. use of cash benefit. The money provided by CLASS could be used on pretty much anything that helps a person complete the daily tasks of life, including pay for an assistant in the home, housing modifications, for example, making a bathroom accessible to a wheelchair, and transportation to shop for groceries. If a beneficiary resides in a nursing home, they may use CLASS money to pay those expenses. Impact on eligibility for other government programs. Participation in the CLASS program would not hinder a person's ability to receive Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, or any other government benefits. The program was designed to supplement these benefits, not replace them. So why did the White House decide not to go forward with CLASS? CLASS was deeply flawed because of its opt-out provision. The Congressional Budget Office thought the non-participation level would be very high, with more than 9 out of every 10 working adults ultimately opting out of CLASS. Because CLASS benefits were guaranteed and because premiums could not be based on a person's health status, the largest number of enrollees would likely have been those who needed assisted living care now or in the near future. Given these facts, CLASS was nothing less than an actuarial nightmare, as the risk pool was almost guaranteed to be heavily lopsided toward the old and disabled, who by definition use more health care services than their payments cover. In the short term, however, the CLASS program would have been smooth sailing from a budgetary standpoint. In the first 5 years, it would have accumulated billions of dollars, and it did not have to pay out any benefits at all during this time, thus making the ugly federal deficit look slightly better as government revenue increased on paper. For many CLASS critics, the White House understood the plan was deeply flawed and insisted on including it in Obamacare to create the revenues to fund the new law. Over the next decade, the CBO projected that CLASS would have taken in $70 billion in surplus revenue from an average monthly premium of $123. With that extra $70 billion created through budgetary sleight of hand, the administration was able to claim that Obamacare actually would reduce the federal budget deficit. Despite White House reassurances, fears about CLASS were prevalent before Obamacare's passage. This is a scary proposition where the government passes a huge new entitlement program with gimmicks and tricks, and the American people don't know they will be automatically enrolled in it by their employer if they don't watch out, said Devin Nunes, a Republican congressman from California who opposed Obamacare. Even those who voted for Obamacare had concerns about CLASS. 6 Democrats in the Senate and independent Senator Joe Lieberman refused to support it. Senator Kent Conrad, a Democrat from North Dakota, called CLASS a Ponzi scheme and something that Bernie Madoff would be proud of. He used that characterization because the money taken in over the first 5 years would not have been put in a designated government bank account, but would have been used instead to fund other federal programs. Like Social Security payments made to beneficiaries today, the only thing that would have funded CLASS when it came time to pay out benefits would have been paper IOUs, not real money. Fortunately, with the demise of CLASS, these fears have disappeared. Promoting in-home long-term care. Medicaid is often thought of as the government program that provides health care for children and poor Americans. That perception is true enough, but about one-third of its budget, around $100 billion each year, also funds assisted living and nursing home care, much of it for senior citizens. Medicare, the program we most think of as helping to care for seniors, does not provide such support. Under Obamacare, Medicaid will continue to provide long-term care as it has in the past for those who live in nursing homes. But the new law strives to broaden the reach of the program to include those who live in their own homes, who need help living day to day. It does this by offering states more federal money for in-home assisted living care, the net effect of which will be to encourage seniors to stay out of more expensive nursing homes. In showering financial support on the nursing home industry over the years, Medicaid has inadvertently undermined in-home and community-based assisted living services. Most seniors would understandably prefer to avoid being sent into a nursing home where they are disconnected from their families. Obamacare makes a sensible effort to align Medicaid with this preference. The new law also loosens Medicaid eligibility rules as they apply to long-term care. In the past, a married couple would have had to exhaust all savings and assets in order to qualify for Medicaid long-term care benefits. Now, spouses will be able to retain more financial resources without hurting his or her partner's chances of receiving help through Medicaid. Helping dual eligibles. One of the biggest challenges for anyone who needs long-term care is dealing with the government bureaucracy that is the gatekeeper to assisted living benefits. For a senior citizen who has one or more chronic ailments and needs day-to-day assistance, that means getting help from both Medicare and Medicaid. In most cases, Medicare supports their medical needs, but Medicaid covers the rest of their non-medical care. According to the Kaiser Foundation, almost 10 million people receive both Medicaid and Medicare benefits. These so-called dual eligibles are the most needy Americans receiving government assistance. More than $200 billion is spent each year to care for them, and on a per capita basis, they require four times as much spending as non-duals. And yet, despite the financial burden generated by this group, very little attention has been paid to them. Obamacare seeks to change that. For the first time, Medicare and Medicaid will be encouraged to work together much more than they have in the past in delivering services to dual eligibles. The Department of Health and Human Services will create a new federal coordinated health care office, which will coordinate the delivery of benefits to this important group. The new office will streamline bureaucratic procedures for dual eligibles, remove regulatory conflicts between Medicare and Medicaid, and eliminate any unnecessary overlap in care. Nursing home transparency and improvement. Medicaid enhancements are largely focused on helping provide better long-term care for people who stay in their own homes. But Obamacare also tries to improve the condition of those who reside in nursing homes. Under the law, nursing homes must comply with an array of new rules and regulations intended to protect the elderly who live in such facilities and improve the quality of their lives. Here are the highlights. Ownership disclosure. In recent years, many nursing homes have been bought by private investment firms, attracted to the business because of the stable revenue streams generated by Medicare and Medicaid. This trend has made it more difficult to pinpoint the parties accountable when the level of care falls to an unacceptable level. The new law requires ownership transparency of all nursing homes so that the voices of residents are not ignored. State monitoring. Each state will be required to gather information on the performance of nursing homes and provide public access to this information on a website. They must also make available a standardized complaint form that residents and their families can use to take action against a specific nursing home. Metrics on nursing home quality. Each facility will be required to reveal information about the size and quality of its staff, how much they're paid, the hours of care they provide to residents each day, their turnover and retention rates, the number and type of complaints against them, and their criminal records if they have them. Nursing homes will also be required to reveal any penalties that their facilities have received in the past. website tool. Newly collected information about nursing home performance and quality will be provided on the Medicare.gov website in conjunction with its Nursing Home Compare tool. Ethics programs. To help reduce poor care and criminal activity, each facility will establish rules of conduct for its staff and publicly reveal levels of compliance. Notice of closure. All nursing homes will be required to give at least 60 days' notice to residents if they intend to close. What about death panels? A big controversy in the national debate over Obamacare came when Sarah Palin posted the following statement on her Facebook page. "The America I know and love is not one in which my parents or my baby with Down syndrome will have to stand in front of Obama's death panel so his bureaucrats can decide based on a subjective judgment of their level of productivity in society whether they are worthy of health care. Such a system is downright evil." Palin's fears were fueled by a provision written into the health reform legislation by Democrats in the House of Representatives that funded voluntary consultations between doctors and Medicare recipients about end-of-life issues, touching on such things as living wills and hospice care. She was also disturbed by the controversial views of one of President Obama's advisors on health care reform, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, the brother of former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. Palin was reacting in part to Dr. Emanuel's controversial statements about end-of-life care, in which he pointed out that as much as 80% of a person's health care costs come at the end of their life, and that some independent group that can give you advice was required to help reduce such expenditures. If you remember this controversy and worry that you or a member of your family will one day have to deal with a death panel, there is reason not to worry. Obamacare guarantees that the government must ensure that the health benefits established as essential not be subject to denial to individuals against their wishes on the basis of the individual's age or expected length of life or the individual's present or predicted disability, degree of medical dependency, or quality of life. A sticky point is that the phrase essential health benefits has not yet been defined by the Obama administration. A general outline of the essential health benefits was announced in November 2012, but no specific information about coverage was included. Chapter 14, Obamacare, etc. Obamacare calls for a series of sweeping changes in certain segments of the healthcare industry that will have a ripple effect on everything from how insurance companies will cover people who retire from the workforce before age 65 to the regulation of physician-owned hospitals, the way doctors currently do business, and the operation of federally funded community health centers that serve needy populations. Early Retiree Reinsurance Plan. With so much of Obamacare devoted to decreasing the uninsured population, many of whom are in early adulthood, it's easy to forget that the new law also includes a provision that helps those at the other end of the age spectrum who have recently left the nation's labor force. Specifically, it calls for a new reinsurance program that encourages employers to continue to provide health insurance to their early retirees over the age of 55 but younger than 65, the age the retirees become eligible for Medicare. Under the reinsurance plan, the federal government reimburses employers for 80% of insurance claims between $15,000 and $90,000. The program began in mid-2010 with $5 billion in federal financing behind it and will be discontinued in January 2014. At that point, early retirees will be able to buy health insurance through state-based exchanges. By the end of 2010, almost 4,000 employers and unions had signed up for the reinsurance program. Unlike the government's high-risk pool for individuals who cannot get coverage because they have a pre-existing health condition, the retiree reinsurance program is off to a good start. Restrictions on physician-owned hospitals. It's not an exaggeration to say that Obamacare declares war on physician-owned hospitals. There is no official ban on these institutions. Those that exist now can still operate. But new ones constructed after December 31, 2010 will no longer be certified by Medicare, and thus will not be able to access this all-important revenue stream, which most hospitals need to survive. Exemptions are possible under some circumstances, so some physician-owned hospitals could still be built. But their growth will be seriously curtailed by the new law. Obamacare's war on physician-owned hospitals comes in response to criticism of these institutions made by community and nonprofit hospitals, which have argued that they focus on lucrative specialties such as orthopedics and cardiac care, and push money-losing efforts such as emergency room care onto them. However valid this criticism may be, the restriction on physician-owned hospitals is ill-timed. More than 30 million more Americans will have to obtain health insurance because of Obamacare's individual mandate, and as a consequence, the demand for services will steadily increase over the next decade. When it does, a bottleneck could form in the healthcare system, making it more difficult to obtain care. The United States will need more hospitals, even those that do not provide a broad level of community care. Help could be on the way to lift the restriction. By the end of 2010, lawsuits on behalf of doctor-owned hospitals had already been filed in federal court, with the Physicians Hospitals of America, a lobbying group, arguing that the new law restricting doctor-owned hospitals is retroactive, arbitrary, vague, contradictory, and violates due process and equal protection. Time will tell whether or not this argument proves persuasive. Doctor shortages forecast. Critics of Obamacare assert that the new law will decrease both the quality and number of American doctors, and do so at a time when their services will be in higher demand than ever before. If their prediction comes true, the consequences for healthcare in the United States would be disastrous. Not only would it become much harder to find a doctor, the price you would have to pay for their services could rise significantly. Will this doomsday scenario actually happen? As with so much of the law's future impact, it's hard to say. A growing consensus, however, sees the potential for destabilization of the medical profession and a possible exodus as an unintended consequence of Obamacare. The Association of American Medical Colleges, for instance, estimates that by 2015, the country will need 60,000 more doctors than it is expected to have by then. It expects the shortage to worsen through 2025. Investors Business Daily predicts a much worse doctor shortage. By its estimate, as many as 360,000 physicians could leave the profession rather than accept the changes that are coming. The newspaper's August 2009 forecast was based on a survey conducted among 1,300 doctors during the national debate over the new law. The survey revealed significant dissatisfaction among the nation's physicians regarding the reform package that was ultimately pushed through Congress. Of those doctors who responded, 44% said that they would consider leaving their practice or taking an early retirement if Congress passed Obamacare. Some have suggested the timing of the poll, it was conducted right at the height of national debate on Obamacare, dramatically inflated those numbers. Critics of the poll suggested the notion that more than 4 in 10 of the nation's doctors would choose a new career or simply stop practicing medicine rather than live by the new laws was simply preposterous. Supporters of the new law attacked the Investors Business Daily survey, branding it a partisan distortion with no merit. But it was more or less confirmed by a more recent survey of 2,400 doctors. Commissioned by the Physicians Foundation, the new poll was conducted at the end of 2010. As with the previous poll, a large number of the doctors surveyed, 40%, expressed dissatisfaction, claiming that they would retire, seek a non-clinical job in healthcare, or seek a job or business unrelated to healthcare before the big pieces of Obamacare are implemented in 2014. Well, it's unlikely that 4 out of every 10 doctors will actually leave their profession because of Obamacare. Survey claims about future behavior rarely match reality. Some departures might occur. If even 1 in 10 doctors decides they don't want to participate in the new system, it will be a blow to the quality and availability of healthcare in the United States. Funding for community health centers. Obamacare provides $11 billion in funding for community health centers, which are federal subsidized clinics that provide health care for uninsured Americans in underserved areas, such as inner cities and rural locales. The funding is recognition that despite the individual mandate, the expansion of Medicaid, and the new health care exchanges, millions of people in the country will remain without insurance. The estimated 13 million illegal aliens, for example, will by law remain outside the system but still need care. Community health centers will help address this problem, and hospital emergency rooms will remain places where anyone without insurance can turn to receive care. Part 5. Crunching the Numbers. Chapter 15. Obamacare's Price Tag. Obamacare, the most expensive entitlement program created in the United States since Medicaid and Medicare were created almost 50 years ago, comes with a massive price tag of $1 trillion over the next decade. In an ordinary time of peace and prosperity, that might be a number the American people could easily swallow. But these are not ordinary times. As the United States continues to fight a prolonged, low-intensity war against radical Islamic terrorists, it is simultaneously burdened by an almost incomprehensible national debt of $14 trillion and growing. Viewed against this mountain of money, another $1 trillion thrown onto the pile might not seem like much of an additional burden. On the other hand, it might just be the straw that breaks the nation's back, especially if the real price of Obamacare is significantly higher than what it's projected to cost by today's budget forecasters. The authors of Obamacare, knowing that the gigantic price of major health care reform could derail their efforts to make it a reality, took extra pains to finance the new health care system without adding to the nation's annual budget deficit. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, they were successful, achieving significant reform that should, in theory, pay for itself without increasing the nation's debt. President Obama and congressional Democrats achieved this difficult-to-believe budgetary miracle by cutting the spending of existing programs, such as Medicare, and creating a whole new array of taxes, fees, and penalties that the American people, employers, and the healthcare industry as a whole will have to pay. If the government's financial projections are accurate, these new revenue-generating schemes will raise $1.2 trillion between 2010 and 2019 and be more than enough to cover the anticipated cost of Obamacare over that time period. Note on Congressional Budget Office Obamacare budget forecast. The above numbers and those given in this book reflect the Congressional Budget Office's original estimate of the cost of Obamacare. Since then, the Supreme Court has ruled that states may opt out of the expansion of Medicaid, with the result that the government may have to pay for Medicaid coverage for millions fewer than it expected. It is impossible to say right now how many states will opt out, but the CBO believes the cost savings will be about $84 billion, a negligible amount given the law's $1 trillion price tag. Amazing as it may sound, Obamacare will not only pay for itself, according to these official nonpartisan projections, but will generate extra revenue to the tune of $143 billion, which in turn will be used to reduce the federal budget deficit. Citing these numbers, supporters of the new law were able to tell the American people that the large entitlement program they wanted to create would actually make the nation's financial condition better, not worse. Should we believe the projection used to make this assertion? If history is any guide, the answer is no. When we look at the original budget forecasts for other large entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, we see tremendous understatement of the actual long-term costs of these programs. Back in the 1960s, for instance, the House Ways and Means Committee, there was no Congressional Budget Office back then, predicted Medicare would cost $12 billion by 1990. The real number was almost $100 billion, more than 8 times higher than the forecast. Families USA, a group that supported Obamacare, commissioned an independent analysis of the CBO's forecast for the new healthcare system and discovered that it was wildly understated, particularly the estimate for the amount of money needed to provide subsidies on the health insurance exchanges. According to its analysis, the actual amount needed to fund the exchanges in their first year, 2014, will be more than 5 times higher than the CBO estimate. One expert says one thing about the cost of Obamacare, and one says another. Whom should we believe? The answer is neither. All budget forecasters base their projections on assumptions that, in reality, are best guesses. The truth is, no one really knows how much Obamacare costs, since the actual price will hinge on behavior that can't be predicted. On the other hand, as Bob Dylan once said, you don't need a weather vane to know which way the wind is blowing. Common sense says that insuring more than 30 million people and simultaneously guaranteeing that every citizen has a plethora of new health care benefits will impose a significant financial burden on taxpayers that did not exist before Obamacare's passage. Where does the money generated by Obamacare go? If we want to boil Obamacare down to its most important parts, all we need to do is look at what eats up most of its budget. Two big pieces of the new healthcare system immediately jump off Obamacare's balance sheet: the expansion of Medicaid and the health insurance exchanges. Taken together, they constitute an overwhelming 84% of the cost of the new law, or about $900 billion, with the exchanges costing $465 billion and the expansion of Medicaid costing another $434 billion. The rest of Obamacare's spending, $176 billion, is window dressing in comparison. Where does the money for Obamacare come from? In order to pay for Obamacare over the next decade, President Obama and congressional Democrats cobbled together revenue from a variety of sources, but one stands out prominently: Medicare. The largest source of funding for the new healthcare system comes from Medicare spending cuts, followed by an assortment of new taxes and fees imposed across the board. Let's take a closer look at each revenue source. Medicare spending cuts. The Obamacare cuts to Medicare's budget are discussed at length in another section of this book, Chapter 10, entitled Turning the Screws on Medicare. Increased Medicare hospital insurance tax. One of the biggest sources of revenue for Obamacare, besides Medicare spending cuts, will come in the form of an increase in the Medicare hospital insurance tax that American workers pay. The current tax is 2.90%, with the employer and employee both contributing 1.45%. The new law raises the employee portion of this tax to 2.35% for high-income earners, specifically for individuals who make more than $200,000 per year and for couples who make more than $250,000 per year. After the increase goes into effect in 2013, the new hospital insurance tax, employer and employee share combined, will be 3.80% on income above the new thresholds. Increased Medicare Unearned Income Investment Tax. Another important source of revenue will come from the Medicare contribution tax imposed on individuals making more than $200,000 per year and couples earning at least $250,000 per year. The tax will only apply to investment income, such as capital gains, interest, dividends, annuities, royalties, and rents above the income thresholds. The new tax will go into effect January 1, 2013. This new 3.8% tax has raised fears that it represents a new transfer tax on the capital gains of homeowners when they realize a profit from the sale of their home. While in some cases the tax could apply to home sales in this way, most Americans will not be affected by it. Here's why. Some may be wondering, what if they sell their house for a big profit and vault over the $250,000 threshold in a given year? Won't they have to pay the tax then? Probably not, if they live in the home they are selling. In the 1990s, President Clinton signed into law an exemption to the capital gains tax for those who sell their own home and realize a profit under $500,000, married couples, and $250,000, individuals. Clinton's exemption is still in place, and the new Obamacare 3.8% surtax only applies above the $500,000 and $250,000 profit levels. Right now, a married couple that realizes a capital gains profit exceeding $500,000 on the sale of a home must pay a 15% tax on the amount above this level. The Obamacare surtax of 3.8% raises it to 18.8%. For those who are selling homes they don't live in, the 3.8% tax will apply to capital gains above the Obamacare thresholds, since these individuals will not enjoy the benefit of Clinton's exemption. Taken together, the two new Medicare taxes imposed on high-income earners, the hospital insurance tax and the investment income tax, are expected to generate $210 billion in revenue over the next decade, or about 17% of the funding needed to pay for Obamacare. New fees on pharmaceutical and health insurance industries. Obamacare will impose significant new fees on the pharmaceutical and health insurance industries that will generate $107 billion over the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The fees will be phased in over time for the healthcare industry. Pharmaceutical industry fees will gradually increase in the same way. The new fees on these industries are expected to generate about 9% of Obamacare's revenue over the next decade. The affected industries have accepted these fees without protest, largely because of the 30 million additional customers that Obamacare pushes onto their doorstep with money in hand, ready to buy health insurance and prescription drugs. By their calculation, financial gains from this bigger market will more than offset the $107 billion they've agreed to pay the government. Financial penalties on individuals and employers. The fines imposed on Americans who do not get health insurance and a similar penalty imposed on employers who do not offer coverage to their employees are primarily intended to decrease the number of uninsured in the United States. But they will also generate significant revenue that helps fund Obamacare, because some people and businesses will not comply. In aggregate, the amount generated by the penalties is expected to reach $65 billion over the next decade, or about 5% of Obamacare's revenue. But opponents of the individual mandate, who say that it was put in place to pay for Obamacare, paint a distorted picture, as nearly all of the new healthcare system's funding, 95%, will come from other sources. Excise tax on Cadillac health insurance plans. Hoping to simultaneously generate revenue and discourage excessive spending on healthcare by Americans, the authors of the new law are convinced that overutilization raises costs for everyone. Obamacare imposes a heavy 40% tax on Cadillac insurance plans. Despite what the label Cadillac implies, expensive health insurance plans are held by a broader range of people than Wall Street tycoons and wealthy industrialists. The higher price paid for them is often a function of the holder's age and health status, not his or her net financial worth. Many union workers, for instance, have plans that fall into the Cadillac category, and this is one reason unions oppose the tax. Although the tax is imposed on the insurer, not the policyholder, that is probably a distinction without a difference, since it is likely to be passed on to the customer, raising the overall price of the insurance plan and the premiums associated with it. Showing the power of interest groups opposed to it, the new tax won't take effect until 2018. No one really knows for sure whether the tax will actually be imposed when the time comes. How will the new tax work exactly? Health insurance plans in 2018 and the years after that, which exceed $10,200 in premiums for an individual or $27,500 in premiums for a family, excluding dental and vision coverage, will be taxed at a rate of 40% above the threshold. While these